of those things where looking to the past may actually be a good idea for inspiring the future.
You know, there is one of the greatest fundraisers I've seen is there is an island community in British Columbia where the local nonprofit there sells bulk import from China, little fold-out popping lamps, like little camping lamps.
Okay.
But and it doubles as a bug, like the blue light bug thingy as well. But there is such a temperate climate. And there are so many mosquitoes, and the power grid there is intermittent that it is the perfect product for that community. You know what I mean? Like it is exactly the thing that will fly off like hotcakes in that community because they have that distinct understanding of exactly what it is that
So
community needs. I
you're
think.
saying like Ottawa Pride should sell Ottawa Pride branded dehumidifiers.
Exactly. I was going to say, light rail transit replacement bus service vehicles because, everyone needs one of those. But my point is, let's stick to Halifax here. And I think that this is an interesting challenge for us as a community. If you're a queer person in Halifax, that festival, which happened this past weekend, relied on about $170,000 in sponsor money. So the challenge to that community is, can they amongst themselves raise $170,000? And I would pose this challenge to all of the Pride organizations. Give us a dollar amount that they're getting from sponsors. And if the community can pull itself together and replace that dollar for dollar so the price doesn't have to change, ditch the sponsors. Ditch the corporatization. But if they can't, then I think the community needs to seriously consider, is the celebration that we have possible without it? And I think that that's a hard, tough question that a lot of people will need to think about. What do you think of that idea, like
Yeah, I mean,
funding targets to replace dollar for dollar the sponsor money?
so things like the part of the reason why the parade has gotten so expensive is because so many people are in the parade. Like, let's take Toronto Pride, for example. In some years it's like 3 to 4 hours long, which means you need to shut down the streets for that much longer. And because the parade route is that much longer, you need the buffer zone at the start and the end. So it's not just a matter of shutting down the parade route. You also need to shut down the loading and unloading regions, and then you need all the police to modify it, blah, blah, blah. If you cut the parade in half, if you cut out all the corporate floats, the cost would go down. Not it wouldn't be to scale. It wouldn't be half the number of floats, half the cost, but it would scale down to a degree. And a lot of people are thinking Pride might need to scale down in general. So I think it kind of the savings you get pay for themselves by cutting out the people that you may not want in the first place. You're also saving space on a whole bunch of other stuff. It kind of works out that there is a way to make it work. And a lot of local small businesses often complain that they feel left out by the Pride Festival. If Pride Festival is on Main Street in Citiesville, quite often the local Pride Festivals neglect sometimes to go door to door along Main Street in Citiesville and say, hey, the festival's going to be in the neighborhood. Do you want to buy into it in any way? Do you want to do any advertising? What do you want to do? Like, it's a matter of getting back to that grassroots approach. And I don't know. It's a little bit more rugged, individualistic, stand on your own 2 feet. It's kind of boomer. Like that is very much that boomer attitude, but they are the ones who built the festival in the first place. And if they're the ones who built the festival, maybe we should also look at what was their attitude and approach to the festival to get it to that scale in the first place. Because if government and municipal, like including municipal funding and corporate sponsorship is not working and we need to find an alternative, there already is an alternative existing and we could probably look at it. What did they do? And emulate that to some degree. I think we'd be done. I don't think it's impossible. I do think Pride probably should be scaled back anyway, but a lot of the bloat, a lot of the huge size of Pride is making enough space for the corporate sponsors to send all their Speedo models. And the Speedo models are welcome, but the float that they're standing on is taking up precious space.
Well, I will personally never decline the attendance of Speedo models in the Pride Parade. I do want to quickly address what's been happening in Fredericton. So last week we talked about how just hours before the 10-day festival, the board issued a statement saying that it is effectively cancelled. It triggered a string of resignations in the board, lots of media coverage of it, even though those involved refused to talk to any media. I think we see a swing in that transparency from Halifax to Fredericton. Mm-hmm. But what we have seen is an incredible group of people got ushered in on Monday. There was emergency votes and or urgent votes, at least, and new members of the Fredericton Pride Board were pulled together. They are now working tirelessly, very much in the week of the Pride Parade. As far as we can tell, they have now announced that the Pride Parade will happen. You might want to check it locally. It is a moving target for whether or not this is happening. But as far as we are aware at the moment, it is happening on Sunday at 3 p.m. I think they're working with the city on the permits. There's stuff afoot happening in Fredericton. But we'll keep an eye on it. So people stepped up, saved the day. More than half the events have been confirmed as definitely happening anyway. Mm-hmm. A lot of community organized events happening anyway. So if you're visiting Fredericton for Pride this coming weekend, double check what's happening and what's not happening with their website. And I believe there are accessibility guides floating around as well, which can help. But it's been a roller coaster in the East Coast for Pride this year. All of the East Coast provinces have been all sorts of happening, except for Charlottetown in PEI. That they had their Pride Parade last weekend. It was lovely. Everyone had a great time. And nothing overly noteworthy. But the rest of the provinces are in a scramble. We are going to jump to our next track. This is Crawl by Madison, and we will be back just after this.
Walked around, listened to that song on repeat. Bolted out the door, felt magic in the beat. Something about the world felt in my reach. Didn't let you, didn't let myself, not the state of it all, get in my way, ruin my day, but I sure had to crawl. And I crawled back to what I thought I knew was all. Song in my brain, forgave myself for doing nothing at all again. Took a cycle back to my roots, and then I let myself get a little loose. Yeah, get a little loose.
Away
welcome back to Can Queer, home of Canada's queer media. My name is Luke Smith.
And I'm Sebastian.
I want to stick with New Brunswick for just a moment. Also, I think we're sticking still in Fredericton. The Premier of New Brunswick, Premier Higgs, has continued to ruffle the feathers of the queer community in New Brunswick. This time, there was about 250 protesters. They were carrying such great signage as I need real education and not sex. Stop normalizing sex and nudity. Mm-hmm. And a number of other things as well. But there were protest signs essentially on the side of Premier Higgs introduced legislation around addressing sex education in the province's schools. Mm-hmm. There were about 100 people on the flip side advocating against removing hate from schools, advocating against these very same specific policies. Mm-hmm. The reason for the disgruntled feathers, Premier Higg went out and shook hands with a whole bunch of the anti-2S LGBTQ inclusion policies, but then got whisked away to another event and didn't go and shake the hands of folks on the other side. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that is overly shocking. We're seeing politicians frequently for different protest events. They'll come out and say hi to one side and not typically both.
I don't mind the fact that he went out to talk to them, but the fact that he didn't talk to both sides is a little bit upsetting because, like, I don't like this purity testing thing of how dare you talk to the enemy. Like, talk to them. Find out in their own words what their point is. You know, mm-hmm. if someone is out there protesting, they got something to say, hear them in their own words. If they are ding-dongs or just total donkeys, you know, let them tell you that they're donkeys with their own dumb words, you know? And not only that, but it's also just a matter of I mean, it's good optics to listen to both sides, if anything else, if you want to be cynical about it. But if you do shake hands with one side and then not cross the road and talk to the other people and say, tell me in your own words, what are you advocating for? Then there is a bias there and I'm not into it anymore.
But he's also an elected politician.
Yeah.
Is it better politics? Maybe. But right now, the politics seems to be, you know, beggar thy neighbor, that, which is unfortunate. Mm. I want to move on. There was a somewhat good story coming out of Toronto. A 37-year-old has been arrested after he was spray-painting both Palestinian and pride flags in residential properties around Toronto near DuPont and Symington Avenue. Apparently, a passerby intervened to stop this gentleman from spray painting things. This intervener was then assaulted by the assailant.
Yeah, to be clear, are you saying he was spray painting Palestinian flags onto things, or he was spray painting over?
There was a Palestinian flag. He then spray painted onto that flag as well as pride flags.
Okay.
Anyway, he's been charged, I believe, with assault on accounts of the assault of the man that worked to intervene. We have been following an interesting story out of the Supreme Court around laws, Supreme Court of Canada, I should clarify, around laws made by Parliament or the legislature. In this case, it was a case revolving around the legislature of New Brunswick, where the Supreme Court in Canada has now defined that the state, i.e. the government of Canada or the government of New Brunswick, for example, is liable, so could be financially liable, when they enact laws that are unconstitutional. Now, you might think they make an unconstitutional law, you can sue them for it. That makes sense. But the logic that they've landed on, and I think it's a very reasonable logic, very sort of judicious approach, which is that if, for all intents and purposes, they were following good advice, everything was well-meant, well-intentioned, it was they were doing what they ought to as legislatures in the bit, like, times change, morals evolve, technology evolves, we are frequently fixing laws from 50, 60 years ago, for example. That sort of thing is fine.
The city that I grew up with, Burlington, Ontario, still has a law that says you cannot drag a dead horse up Brand Street during rush hour.
I mean, I think it's a reasonable law.
But specifically Brand Street, specifically rush hour.
Can you imagine the havoc? Like all the adjacent streets, it would just be a nightmare.
But you kind of wonder, like, what historical thing happened there? But every town has zombie laws like that, and they're out there. It's a thing.
So why the Supreme Court, and why I think this is interesting, is they said that they are liable only when the laws enacted are clearly wrong, in bad faith, or an abuse of power. Now, the actual court case wasn't about that, but these decisions kind of create better legal understanding for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to bring it up because we have seen a spattering. Alberta is yet to roll out changes, but it has been thinking about it and working on it. New Brunswick and Saskatchewan have legislation that they've used the notwithstanding clause in the Constitution, specifically to avoid these kinds of challenges. I do wonder if this sort of guidepost by the Supreme Court of Canada being like, look, you could be liable if it is an abuse of power, if it is unconstitutional, if it isn't bad faith. Do you think that this might help to introduce a measure of greater civility in the legislation that's being introduced? We see crazy legislation introduced in the States. A lot of things get introduced that will never pass the first court it hits. We don't see that as much here in Canada, thankfully. But do you think that maybe this might have a calming effect on some of the more radical legislation that we see?
Well, usually, before something is passed, they do run it past constitutional lawyers or the Supreme Court themselves to say, you know, this is a major change in the legal system. Can you double check for us that this is not going to be a problem? I know that's not standard procedure in the sense that, like, it's not required, but it is standard procedure in the sense that a lot of, especially if it's a major law that changes something fundamental, adding the X to the gender section on Canadian passports. They did double check with the Supreme Court before they ratified that legislature that it was constitutional or that it wasn't violating anything or it didn't contradict some other law. Like you normally get your legal experts to check. I think it's just an issue of, like, if you're not going to put in a requirement that you have to do this, this is sort of a nice plan B that if you fail to do this, you could be liable for any damages that result. Like, I think at its core, this is something that everyone should agree with. I can't imagine, I don't want to say both sides because left and right is kind of a vacuous concept in current day politics, but left and right would both agree with this because they both look at each other's laws and they say, or proposals for laws, and they'll say that law doesn't make sense or that law violates the Constitution or that law is in bad faith. And every so often, either side could be right about any individual one of them. Like, I think this is fundamentally at its core something that should have existed all along. How it's going to play out, like, how do you organize a class action lawsuit of, like, the people of Canada versus one bad law? That's going to be a little bit hard to organize. I don't know how you would do that. You're going to have certain cases where individual people or specific groups of people are directly impacted, so it'll be obvious. But if it's something like it's illegal to wear unmatching socks, I don't know why you would do that, but I'm just coming up with a ridiculous example. How would you implement that? And if you did overthrow that or overturn that, I should say, how would you sue the government for that on behalf of the people and have every single, because you're just going to have people going like, yeah, I wear unmatching socks all the time. Like, I don't know how you would play that out, but I think at its core, the idea that the government is liable if they do manage to pass a bad law, I got no problem with that. I think most people would have no problem with that.
I mean, I think people may underestimate the motivation that losing a lawsuit has for the government, because it is not cheap when the government loses a lawsuit. My favorite example of this, Canada has a fund for survivors of the LGBT purge. This was policy of the government to oust people suspected of being homosexual as a potential security risk. Very much sort of McCarthy era, lavender scare, the fruit machine was the Canadian element of it. Big thing. And they introduced the fund, they're doing paying out for damages, and everyone's like, oh, this is great news. What's often not mentioned is that the fund is a direct result of a class action lawsuit that the government lost. And now we see similar efforts in the UK, in France, and in the United States, where they are also, you know, magnanimously offering rewards to these victims of these purges. Also having lost or being challenged in lawsuits in each of those countries. Like, you know, legal consequences motivates politicians, thankfully. I still think they should be more personally liable, but that's a conversation for another day. Sticking with Supreme Courts,
right,
I'm going to whiz us across the world to a really interesting Supreme Court decision out of South Korea. They have just issued a landmark ruling on Thursday, saying that essentially denying same-sex couples healthcare benefits based on the gender of their partner was sex orientation discrimination. They say, quote, this is obviously an English translation, "It is an act of discrimination that violates human dignity and value, the right to pursue happiness, freedom of privacy, and the right to equity before the law. And the degree of violation is serious." This is fantastic news out of South Korea. What's the cultural impact, do you think, of this decision in South Korea?
I mean, an analogous decision was made in Canada in the late 90s, and it was the precursor that same-sex marriage and equality marriage launched off of. Like, this is, I don't want to say it's step one, but it is a major step on that path. I believe South Korea has recognition of same-sex couples, but I don't know if they have full legal. I mean, they're now one step closer to fully equally legal. I don't know if they have hospital visitation rights. I don't know if they have what's it called, where you can execute somebody's will, the
power of attorney. Yeah, power of. We know what you mean.
Somebody out there is yelling at their radio. They know what I'm trying to say. Yeah. So a lot of the rights that come from, because marriage is not just about the symbol of marriage. It's also about all the legal rights that somebody has when they're in a relationship, the ability to like determine their partner's health decisions if they become incapacitated, the ability to carry out their will, the ability to co-own property, the ability to adopt a child together or to adopt your partner's child. Like, there's a lot of other rights that come out of marriage, and most of the human and civil rights that LGBT people around the world lack, almost all of them, instantly become ratified when you acknowledge same-sex marriage. So having that kind of thing play out in South Korea actually does have a very profound long-term impact on basically the rights and freedoms of individuals in that country who are LGBT.
Well, unfortunately, this week hasn't been all rainbows, pride parades, and boycotts. There is a country that has never explicitly criminalized homosexuality and homosexual acts until now.
Oh, is it Turkey?
It is not Turkey. Okay. No. But it is the African country of Burkina Faso. Burkina Faso was a French territory and did not inherit anti-gay colonial era laws. I bring this up because most of Africa inherited a lot of British and French anti-gay laws and then just never removed them when they reached independence. Burkina Faso is currently under a military junta. And they have decided that they are updating all of their marriage laws. It's a predominantly Muslim country. And they are now making homosexuality legal. The justice minister said, quote, "Henceforth, homosexuality and associated practices will be punished by the law." So quickly cancel your vacation plans to Burkina Faso. We will keep an eye on that and other stories from around the world as we monitor gay news and bring the news and conversation to your ears. Did you have any other stories I may have missed, Sebastian?
Those are the big ones. Yeah.
We are obviously monitoring a number of stories out of the States. It is such a smorgasbord of stories out of there, which get a lot of coverage. We haven't had time to cover them all today. We will also keep an eye on Canada. If you have a lead, you can reach us at TalkCanQueer on most of the social media platforms. I have been Luke Smith.
And I've been Sebastian, and thank you for listening.
Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Are you struggling with an LGBT issue? Maybe you're a parent, a family member, employer, a coworker, an educator, a healthcare provider. PFLAG is Canada's only national organization that helps all Canadians who are struggling with issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflagcanada.ca.